Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the Old Testament, the story of the creation, fall, and beginning of the redemption of all humankind. This is number two of our part two section that our guest, Ron Eldred, has been teaching us for these past several weeks. And of course, Ron is the teacher of religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High for the past 11 years. And he's been a stalwart on this program, teaching us about the Old and the New Testament. I'm your host, Father Larry Moran, chaplain down at Carmelite Convent, just south of Terre Haute, at the entrance of Allendale. Ron, we just finished up with the book of Judges, and we're coming now to the book of Ruth. We're in what is called the historical books of the Old Testament, although it's a little bit different history than we consider modern history. But before we go to the book of Kings, could we say something about the book of Ruth? Because it has an important part to play in the history of the Old Testament, leading us to the Messiah.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing to do. You know, to discuss the book of Ruth and try to point out why it is so historically important. And you mentioned, too, before we go into the book of Kings, the reason we were going, of course, get into that is that because of the anarchy that existed during the time of the judges, the people began to demand, later on, Samuel, of course, who was the great prophet and the last of the judges, that they have a king like all the rest of their enemies. And so Ruth comes right in before that period, before we actually get into the kings. And it is very important, I think, to salvation history, because Ruth was the great-grandmother of King David, the ancestor of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. In the story, Ruth, a Moabite or a non-Israelite, marries one of the sons of Elimelech, husband of Naomi. They're Israelites. So in other words, she's a pagan woman. And because of a famine in their land, Naomi and her family moved to Moab. When her husband dies, Naomi's two sons marry Moabite women, one of them being Ruth, and then the sons die. And this leaves Ruth and her sister-in-law widows with Naomi. When Naomi hears that the famine had ended in her homeland, Judah, she resolved to return there. And before leaving, she encouraged her daughters-in-law, including, of course, Ruth, to return to their respective families so that they could find new husbands to care for them. But Ruth refuses to leave Naomi. So even though she was a foreigner and a pagan, she travels with her mother-in-law to Bethlehem. And Ruth stays in the land with Naomi and remains faithful to the God of Israel, rather than returning to her homeland and taking up the worship of the gods of her people, the pagan gods of her people. To reward her for her fidelity to Naomi and himself, God gives Ruth a new husband, the influential and prosperous Boaz of Bethlehem. He was a kinsman of her dead husband, probably a cousin. And Boaz had met Ruth one day as she gleaned ears of grain in his fields. Remember, we had talked about the gleaning, where each person who owned land was to save a certain part of the field. This is back when we were talking about the law of Moses, and not, harvest.
Come and gather some food.
And so she's going in, gleaning some, because she's poor. Gleaning ears of grain in his fields. And he favors her because she has been faithful to Naomi. And Ruth claims him as her husband by the law of affinity. In other words, relationship. And he marries her after a near kinsman refuses to do so. Another way of looking at this arrangement is Boaz had purchased land that belonged to Naomi's husband, Elimelech, and Ruth was included in the bargain. And as a result of this marriage, Ruth's lineage eventually includes both King David and the Messiah, Jesus Christ. Ruth and Boaz's son was named Obed, who was the father of Jesse, who was the father of David. And this means, of course, that Jesus of Nazareth had both Jewish and Gentile ancestry.
Okay. Well, why is the book of Ruth placed between the books of Joshua and 1 Samuel?
The book of Ruth is placed just after Judges because the events described therein occurred at the time of the Judges. Since the events occurred just before 1 Samuel, or 1 Samuel, it's an excellent introduction to that book because Ruth traces the ancestry of the Davidic dynasty, connecting the period of the Judges to that of the kings. Although the literary form of this story is dramatic or in the form of a novelette, many biblical scholars believe it contains true history. Scholars estimate that it was written between 1000 and 700 BC, but there are some who opt for even later authorship.
Okay, there's a lot of guesswork in time periods about when exactly these books were written and the time that they're talking about. So you're usually trying to give a good centrist opinion about what the most scholars would say about the ordinary times, give or take some. Well, and this brings us up to the book of Samuel. And of course, Samuel was a tremendous prophet. Can you give us the outline of these books, 1 and 2 Samuel?
Well, I have to give a little background here to set the stage for the events described in the books of Samuel. Before he died, Joshua warned the people not to choose an earthly king to rule over them. Instead, this even goes back to Deuteronomy. Instead, they were to rely on God alone as their king. During the time of the Judges, God would call various men and women to unite and lead all the tribes against their enemies in time of emergency, as we pointed out when we talked about the book of Judges. But when the emergencies were over, the judges would cease their leadership over the tribes. It included people like Samuel and people like Samson and Gideon and other such people.
Deborah.
She was at least one of the women. I think there was another. The judges were able to defeat the Canaanites who arose against them and to repel invaders from the desert. However, their greatest enemy was to be the Philistines, a people originally from the land of Crete, who conquered the coast of Canaan while Joshua was busy conquering the hill country in the center of the land. They even threatened the Egyptian Nile Delta and had started to conquer the inland territory of Canaan, these Philistines. Their presence became so prevalent that the land was soon named after them, Palestine. When the Israelites fell into idolatry, they were oppressed by the Philistines, who later became their traditional persecutors.
Okay, did the Philistines ever capture the Ark for a while, which was a frightening thing?
Yes, they did, because they had strayed from God's law. The Israelites were soundly defeated by the Philistines and were ruled by them for about 100 years. This was during the time of the Judges. When they captured the Ark of the Covenant, this story is told in 1 Samuel chapters 4 through 6, they demanded that the Israelites take it back because God had inflicted them with various catastrophes as long as they had it. The Israelites experienced a little relief from their oppression during Samson's rule, and Saul was to defeat and drive them from the hill country. But it was only under David that the Israelites were united and the Philistines driven out, for the most part, out of the land of Canaan or the promised land.
Okay, let's talk a little about Saul, the first king of Israel, even though Joshua had warned them. Was it Joshua the one who had warned them not to go to a king?
Yes, and in fact, the story, it even goes back to Deuteronomy, you know, that they should, that the Israelites should not have a king, but certainly Samuel reminds them of this.
Okay.
And before his death, right before his death.
Well, say a word or two about the story of Saul's reign, who was the first king, in spite of the warnings that the Israelites had been given.
Well, 1 and 2 Samuel tells the story of the change of the chosen people from a confederacy of 12 independent tribes to a centralized monarchy ruled by a king whose authority comes from God. Because they were continually attacked by their enemies and too disorganized to effectively resist them, the Israelites asked Samuel, the last of the judges, and also a prophet, to give them a king like all their enemies had. God gave them what they wanted and commanded Samuel to anoint Saul, the first king of the kingdom of Israel. This story is told in 1 Samuel chapter 9. To briefly summarize the books of Samuel, the first part of 1 Samuel recounts Samuel's birth and his youth. The loss and recovery of the ark is found in chapters 4 through 7. The establishment of Saul as king is found in 8 through 11. So this is in 1 Samuel where you find the story of Saul. Recounted next is how Saul sinned and lost the favor of God. This is told in chapters 12 through 13. Yet Israel's victories continued. We find this in 14 and 15. And the second half of the book begins with the Lord's call on Samuel to anoint a new king. And a shepherd boy named David was chosen. So the story of David begins to emerge in 1 Samuel. The story when David slew Goliath, the enemy's champion, is told in the 17th chapter of 1 Samuel. And Saul, of course, becomes envious of the boy and sought to kill him. That whole story is told in chapters 18 through 20. David, however, escaped and collected his own band of men. That's told in 21 through 23. And when David passed up an opportunity to have Saul killed, the king acknowledged David's innocence. And this is told in chapters 24 through 26. And in the end of this chapter, Saul is killed by the Philistines.
Even though Saul was determined to kill David, David still respected him as the king and did not kill him when he had a great opportunity to.
Because he was God's anointed.
And this was the conversion of Saul to realize how innocent of any trying to take over the kingdom David was. Okay, Ron, we've talked about the book of number 1 Samuel. How about 2 Samuel?
2 Samuel continues the story of David. After the death of Israel's first king, Saul, David mourned him, told in chapter 1, became king, told in chapters 2 through 4, and he captured Jerusalem. That's in 5. He then had the ark brought to the city, told in 6, but was ordered by a prophet, Nathan, not to build a house for it. We'll get to that story just a little bit later, but that's told in chapter 7. Victories in battle ensued, told in chapters 8 through 10, but David took another man's wife, and though repentant, was punished. That story, sordid story, is told in chapters 11 through 12, which we'll also get to in a little bit. His sons warred with one another and insulted him. This is told in chapters 13 through 16, and eventually David's enemies were routed, 17 through 20. And his faith was finally rewarded, and this ends, of course, 2 Samuel chapters 20 through 24.
Okay, could we first focus a moment on King Saul?
As I said a while ago, the story of King Saul is told in 1 Samuel. The Hebrew title of the book refers to the leading figure in this book who was responsible for the enthronement of Saul and David. It tells the story of the transition of the Israelites from a loose confederation of tribes into a nation. The book covers the century between the judges and the beginning of the monarchy in Israel under Saul and David. As one Bible commentary states, quote, "It is not a complete and continuous history, nor a systematic account of the period, but rather a series of episodes centered around the persons of Samuel, Saul, and David, the principal figures leading up to the establishment of the royal dynasty of David. End of quote. And as I said earlier, 2 Samuel recounts the history of the Israelite nationhood, especially the story of David. No one knows who the final editor or redactor was, nor do they know the exact time of the completion of the book. Some biblical scholars believe that it was completed late in the 7th century B.C., at least 3 centuries after the persons and events described therein. Whatever the case, scholars think that the Samuel, Saul, Davis narratives were written by a single author, but clearly depend on the several written sources. In other words, somebody wrote these things down, but then somebody later on collected these sources and wrote 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, and I might add 1 Kings and 2 Kings.
Okay, can you tell us about King Saul's role in this progressing salvation history in the Old Testament?
Because all of their enemies had been, had defeated them, had kings, the Israelites became desperate to have their king. So the people begged Samuel, their judge, during the Philistine oppression, to appoint a king over them so that they could be like other nations. Samuel knew that the Israelites were not supposed to have an earthly king, and so he prayed to the Lord for guidance. In fact, Samuel was angry with the people because they wanted a king instead of relying on his leadership. Nonetheless, God told Samuel that he would give them a king so that they could, quote, learn the lesson that earthly kings could never bring lasting peace and happiness to their land, end of quote. So in response to God's command, Samuel called Saul, a military leader, to be the first king of Israel. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, and he was a great warrior. To show that kingship was a sacred role, Samuel anointed him king in a religious ceremony. Paul was given authority not only to rule the people, but the responsibility to rule in harmony with God's will. Saul led the Israelites to victory over their enemies. His first victory as king was at Jabesh, Gilead, which was followed by victories at Moab, Edom, and the Philistines, and then finally the Amalekites. These stories of these battles is told in 1 Samuel 11, chapters 11 through 14. As one source tells us, quote, so long as Saul was obedient to God, his armies were victorious. But Saul was too self-willed, humbly, to accept God's will. He wanted things his own way, not God's. And soon his army suffered reversals, end of quote. The Encyclopedic Dictionary of the Bible says that, quote, troubled by an evil spirit, he was soothed by the music of David's harp. However, he grew jealous of the fame won by David for killing the mighty Philistine giant Goliath. And though he had given David his daughter Michal in marriage, he made numerous attempts on David's life and hunted him down as an outlaw. When David was hiding from Saul, he passed up opportunities to kill Saul twice because he would not raise his hand against the Lord's anointed king. This is the end of that quote. One opportunity arose when Saul entered a cave to relieve himself where David and his men were hiding. And another was when David slipped into Saul's camp while he and his men were sleeping. In other words, they went into the cave to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
And while Saul had his, even describes it sure. in the Bible there, his skirt or something like that, David could have easily killed him at that time.
Okay, why was it that God rejected Saul, who had started out supposedly so well obeying God?
God rejected him because he disobeyed his commandments on several matters. On one occasion after a victory over the Amalekites, God told him to destroy all that they had, saying, do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. This is found in 1 Samuel 15:3. You remember we talked about this in one of our earlier sessions, that God had told them to practice this kind of thing, which was done by all the other armies at the time, because if they didn't kill these people, if they had to take them in, for example, in as prisoners, they didn't have any way to take care of them. They'd have to free men up from the battle to take care of these prisoners. Another thing is that if they left them in the background, they would, might come in and attack them from the back. Also, if they didn't kill them, these people would live among them, and the Israelites would tend to stray and start intermarrying with the pagan people and picking up their religion and things of that sort as well. So instead of following God's command to the letter, Saul spared the king and the animals, although he did have all of the men, women, and children killed. Saul told Samuel that he hadn't killed the animals because the people wanted to spare them for sacrifice. Samuel told him that it was job to lead the people, not follow them, that it was better to obey God's commandments and not the will of the people. So after being admonished by Samuel for his disobedience, hacked the Amalekite king to pieces. Because Saul had not been a faithful king, he lost God's favor through his disobedience. Therefore, God sent Samuel to anoint David, who was only a shepherd, to replace him. Of course, when Saul heard about this, the rift between he and David intensified. So David was forced to escape and seek refuge among the Philistines for a while. In fact, the Philistines made him a king of a small town in the surrounding territory for a time. And although he never lifted his sword against his fellow Israelites during this period of exile, he and his men feigned allegiance to the Philistines, while at the same time doing everything he could to undermine them. Well, Saul eventually died in battle against the Philistines at Mount Gilboa by falling on his own sword when the battle turned against him. This story is told in 1 Samuel 16, chapter 16. And so David was able to claim that he had no part in Saul's death because the Philistines had sent him away before the battle, fearing that he and his small army of young men would turn on them during the battle. And after Saul's death, David was crowned king by popular acclamation, although, of course, he was God's choice. But he didn't gain complete control of Canaan, actually, for several years.
Okay, so Saul falls on his own sword, kills himself because he's been wounded, not wanting to be taken alive. What about then David begins his reign as king, supposedly one of the greatest kings of Israel?
Initially, David was only able to gain control over the southern tribes, including his own tribe of Judah, and I think a part of the tribe of Benjamin. The northern tribes of Israel, which was the majority of the tribes, resisted his rule, and a civil war ensued for a time. A man by the name of Abner, he was commander of Saul's army, which still existed, a part of it was anyway, and he had made one of Saul's surviving sons, Ish-bosheth, king of the northern tribes, including the tribe of Benjamin, which was Saul's tribe. 2 Samuel tells us that, quote, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. In other words, even after Saul was killed, he still had someone who was a follower of his who took over and took over his army, and so David had to defeat this army. Eventually, Abner was to have a falling out with Ish-bosheth. So he reconciled with David, and the northern tribes came to recognize David as their king as well. 2 Samuel says of this development, so, quote, so all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And at Jerusalem, he reigned over all of Israel and Judah 33 years. This story is told in 2 Samuel chapter 5.
Okay, doesn't the book of Samuel, 1 Samuel, contain one of the most significant theological contributions in the Old Testament, Nathan's oracle promising David an eternal dynasty?
Yes, this famous prophecy is found in chapter 7 of 2 Samuel, about which one source says, quote, became the basis for the development of a royal messianism throughout the Bible, end of quote. After David drove the Philistines from the Promised Land by the year 1000 B.C., he made Jerusalem his capital. And after capturing the city, he brought the Ark of the Covenant there, but he was ordered by the prophet Nathan not to build a house for it. Instead of David building God a house, God is to build David's a house that is to last forever, the house of David, from which the Messiah was to come. God's covenant with David extended to a kingdom with many nations. Through the prophet Nathan, God made a covenant with David that his descendants would rule forever. The Bible says of this covenant, quote, and your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. This is again as found in 2 Samuel 7.
Okay. And isn't this the covenant, the basis for the church's teaching that Jesus Christ descended from the house of David?
Yes, the Catechism tells us on this covenant, quote, the law, the sign of God's promise and covenant, ought to have governed the hearts and institutions of that people to whom Abraham's faith gave birth. If you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. But after David, Israel gave in to the temptation of becoming a kingdom like other nations. The kingdom, however, the object of the promise made to David, made by the work of the Holy Spirit, it would belong to the poor according to the Spirit. Jesus the Messiah was of the house of David. David, that ends that quote. David was the ancestor of Jesus Christ the Messiah, whom David foretold in the book of Psalms, Psalms 89. And several other places in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In other words, as we shall see when we discuss the New Testament, David's kingdom and reign foreshadows the kingdom of God and the reign of Jesus Christ. So 2 Samuel 7 is so important because that's where God makes this covenant with David that his kingdom will last forever. And of course, obviously, he's talking about the kingdom that his ancestor, Jesus, will someday, not his ancestor, but his descendant someday will form, and that will last forever.
Well, it's a good place to stop because our time has run out. To our listening audience, we say may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.